episode 13 of Multiverse Musings, a DC Comics podcast. I'm your host, Adam, and with me, as always, is Jordan. How are you, Jordan?
Pretty good, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I had my morning coffee, and I'm ready to get feisty. We finished our DC films. I hate calling it DCEU, so I won't. I know you like calling it that, but I refuse to. we finished our DC films discussion all the way from Man of Steel to Justice League. And now we have 12 months or so to kill before Aquaman gets released. How we're going to fill that time? Well, we have many ideas, but one of them is to go back and look at the DC films of yesteryear. So what better way to start than with both of our favorite characters, Batman? We're going to cover Tim Burton's Batman 89, the one that ignited my passion for Batman to another level. To do that, we are very fortunate to have a fantastic guest with us today. Our guest is none other than Rick Hsu from Batman on Film. Rick, how are you, sir?
Hey now. We always open our show with hey now.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. I was hoping you'd
be guys, I'm doing great. It's an honor to be here. And I, too, have my morning coffee and my my Elsa and Anna coffee mug because I have two little girls.
Very good. You got to represent for the daughters. I totally understand that. I have nieces, and I watch things that I never thought I'd watch on account of them. So I'm right there with you.
Hey, are we going to get a dad gum on this episode, Rick?
Oh, sure.
We're not the original, but we can do when we give nods to BOF, he can definitely throw that in for us. Yeah.
funny side note on the dadgum original thing that Bill Jett Ramey put on Batman on Film, sort of our catchphrase now. So we have T-shirts made with it. It's really funny. I'm born and raised in Texas. I've never said dadgum ever in my life until he brought that to the forefront. Another side note too is that many years ago I was living in Los Angeles and I was bartending at this place called the Saddle Ranch in West Hollywood, and they had a mechanical bull, and the owners and management they were just so excited. We've got this guy from Texas. He's going to show everybody how to ride that mechanical bull. And I literally stood there and I was like, I've never seen one of these in my life until now. So just the Texas stereotypes are funny. And Bill likes this for whatever reason, likes to exploit those.
He likes to play them up. Exactly. Yeah. Just like me being Canadian. Everybody says we say A, and I don't think I've ever said that on the podcast. And I'm like, okay, I don't say that in my life. So I don't know where you people are getting this from, but I never said it. So I don't know. But so Rick, we always like to start the show with asking a few questions of our guest. And obviously, all three of us being Batman fans, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you two questions. One, what is your favorite Batman movie, live action? And two, who is your favorite actor to portray Batman?
Well, one of my favorite comics is The Man Who Falls. And there's many things I love about that comic, but particularly it explores Bruce Wayne in a way that we've never had really seen before, and traveling and training throughout the world and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have to say Batman Begins because it's my favorite film, because there was so much in The Man Who Falls that Nolan put into that movie, and so perfect and beautiful. And to see Christian Bale becoming Batman in a way that we have never seen before, including the film that we're about to discuss, which I love, Batman 89, but we have an argument over at Batman on Film, a little friendly debate on whether or not Batman 89 is a quote origin film. So a question I would actually like to pose to you guys later in the show. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you can get into some semantics with it, but Batman Begins really is the quintessential ultimate origin film. And to see Christian Bale, who's my favorite actor to play Batman, by the way, pound for pound, okay? There's other actors that I love in the role, mm-hmm. including Michael Keaton. But Batman Begins is just – it's not just a quintessential origin story. It's also the film that saved our beloved Batman after Joe Schumacher train-wrecked him in Batman and Robin. And so I'm forever grateful. The Dark Knight is probably – empirically a better movie, but I don't care. Batman Begins is still my favorite, and yeah. Christian Bale is still my favorite actor.
Yeah, and I'm going to agree with you on all counts. Like my thoughts are, Look, Dark Knight is unquestionably the better made film overall, but as a pure Batman film, I got to give it to Batman Begins. And also, Christian, we did an episode recently. It hasn't been released, and I don't think it will be by the time this one, our audiences are listening to this one. But we did an ultimate Batman fan cast, so we took, the different actors who have played the different roles and sort of made our pick for the best of each role. And it was a struggle for me to choose between. So I'll do a little bit of a spoiler. I won't give it away 100%, but to choose between Michael Keaton and Christian Bale, it was I was agonizing live on the show, or well, not live, but on the show. My decision was really made. Finalized during that show, so it was a tough decision.
Here's why it's also a tough decision, because Michael Keaton is awesome. Ben Affleck and B versus S is awesome. Val Kilmer could have been awesome if he was given anything to work with. And Batman Forever has its moments. I don't have this disdain for that film like I do Batman and Robin. Yeah, Batman Forever Batman Forever is a legitimate Batman movie that's worth watching and discussing. Right. Batman and Robin's just silly. But Val Kilmer was cheated because he is just a powerhouse talent, and I would love to have seen him in something with more, more meat and potatoes to it. And look, Affleck aesthetically is by far the most. The guy looks like he just walked off a comic book, and he's spectacular physically looking in the role, and he did a great job in B versus S. Despite my mixed bag feelings of the film, he's not the problem with that movie for me. And but just overall, Christian Bale. Now, I'll say this about Bale. As the series continued and progressed, for whatever reason, I don't know why they let his voice get away from him so much, because there's some legitimate complaints about his bat voice, but those come later. And that's another thing about Batman Begins is Batman Begins has, in my humble opinion, the best on-screen Batman voice ever. But that voice is lost even by the time we get around to The Dark Knight. It gets too gravelly, and then he loses it for whatever reason.
It almost becomes a parody of itself, especially in the last one.
It does. Yeah, Rises gets really out of hand as well. But, I mean, it's still great, and I still love those two. I love all three of those films, but I'm just saying that I just wish they would have just maintained it the way it was. I mean, and one of my favorite lines in any Batman film ever is seeing, and also you see Batman crouch for the first time in live action. He's just up on Gordon's roof.
That's perfect. Yeah.
And he just says, "Storm's coming." That's all he says.
Yeah.
And it's just, I remember that line, "Storm's coming," and my jaw hit the ground in the theater. I'm like, I might be the only person in here that resonates with the way it is, but that's Batman. That's the Batman I know from the comics, right there, crouching. And you know what I'm saying? We had never seen that even in this brilliant movie we're about to discuss. You never saw that.
We got it twice in that movie too, because he did it with Rachel too in when he saved her
on the L.
He was crowd. What's that?
On the L train.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Oh yeah.
And I will say one more thing about that line. Is that it comes back around in The Dark Knight Rises in a scene with Selina, the storm coming line.
Yeah.
So I love that connective tissue there. And you know, the voice, Bale's voice never bothered me. It really didn't, because to me it just felt like, it felt like that was a natural thing that he would do to try and strike fear into the hearts of criminals. So it feels like, to me, it worked in all three of the films, to be honest.
Well, and Jordan, I'm not certainly saying that I hate it in the other two films. In fact, the only time I think it's really distracting is in The Dark Knight, where he's captured the Joker, he's hanging upside down, and they're breaking each other down mentally, and you're going to spend the rest of your years in a padded cell. But it's like, destiny, you don't believe in good. It's way, way too much. And so, but other than that, it's still great. And I just hope that when people talk about, there's kind of a stereotype about his voice being, overdone or whatever. I'm like, well, it is a little bit, but let's face it. He's also creating a Batman in a universe that exists in the world that we live in. And if Bruce Wayne is going to coexist, he has to not sound anything like Bruce Wayne.
Right.
And to your point also, Jordan, about him striking fear, I couldn't agree more, but man, is there a better moment than in Batman Begins where he pulls up, I'm going blank.
Was it Flouse?
Flouse, yes, thank you. you know, and it's swear to me, you know, that whole thing. Where are the other drugs going?
You know what? I gotta be honest. That freaked me out because I had never seen something on that level with Batman, right? So it's like
rage.
I'm like, this is intimidating. Like, it worked on me. I'm like, I saw him there, and before he spoke, I'm like, all right, this is gonna be. But never did I expect that. I'm like, damn it, that was intimidating. Well done.
All right, F it, guys. Let's just turn the show into the Batman Begins show. So
yeah, you know what's funny? Bill would be upset about that because we haven't scheduled to come on for that show. So before we can get to Batman Begins, we have to cover the genius that was Batman 89. So, Jordan, why don't you start us off, as always, with the briefest summary of a movie that everybody who listens to this podcast should have seen.
Oh, no, you forgot about the news, Adam.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. There is news, very briefly. There is a DC film on the way in 2019 that follows Aquaman in 2018, and that one is Shazam, directed by David F. Sandberg. It's being distributed and produced by New Line. Is that correct? Am I correct on that?
That's correct.
Okay. And there's casting news, right, Jordan?
That is also correct.
What do we got? Tell us what we got.
We got Jack Dylan Grazer being cast in the role of Billy's friend, Freddie Freeman, in Shazam.
And that's one of the kids from It, right?
That is also correct. Yeah, he's 14 years old. He was in It earlier this year. And, he's going to be playing Freddie.
Awesome. Rick, what's your take on the Shazam film and the casting, even so far, and then including this new bit of news?
I don't know much about this kid. I'll trust the casting directors of anything in these DC films, DCU, whatever you want to call them. They have not had a problem with casting. That's been pretty top notch across the board, going all the way back to Man of Steel. Here's my thoughts on Shazam, just real quick. This is what I hope and suspect that they'll do, but I really want them to blow this thing up and make this a full throttle, just goofy, fun, crazy, off the walls film. So I just hope that what they do with this thing is go all out. I want this thing to be a live action Incredibles. I want this thing just to be off the charts, tongue in cheek, fun, loud. I want it to be PG, so it's kid friendly. That's the direction I hope they go with this thing in. And by doing that, I don't see how in the world they could connect it to any existing tissue, because it would, aesthetically and everything, it would be very inconsistent. So that's my hopes for the film. So we'll see. We're going to find out soon enough what exactly they do. And by the way, I say this not because of the current status of DC on film. I don't care if Justice League did $14 billion and was a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, I would still want Shazam to be a standalone film. That's just my view.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I mean, look, you're 100% right. It should be PG. I've said on the show before, when we've covered the different pieces of news, that if they don't make this some sort of cross between Superman 78, Big, and Harry Potter, they've royally screwed up. I mean, that's what it should be. As far as the cast,
did you just reference Penny Marshall, Tom Hanks, Big? That's freaking awesome.
I did. I
love that. What a great reference. I love that.
But I mean, what else could it be? Like, how else could you play that? It has to be.
I think Zachary Levi's even referred to it as that. He said it's like Big with superheroes. I think Zachary Levi said it himself.
And that's the right way to go. I mean, also, if it's marketed right and the film is actually, you know, good and gets good word of mouth and good praise, look, I have no qualms about saying this. There's a very real possibility that Shazam could open better and make more money than Justice League. It's a fact. So, but you got to gear these things. Like, this one has to be geared to all ages. It just does. And the Incredibles mention that you made, Rick, is spot on as well. Let's do this thing. Let's have some fun with it. And, you know, just go embrace what it is. Embrace the source material. Don't shy away from it.
Right. Just run with it.
Yeah.
Like, no handcuffs.
Jordan,
so anyway.
Jordan, any other thoughts before we get into Batman 89?
Yeah, well, you know, Rick, I think you thought we were going to be on further apart on this than we actually are, I think, because I think personally, I think your approach that you'd like to see with the film, I think that's spot on for what I'd want to see for it too. It's just that I feel that you can do that within the confines of the DCEU. You look at what the MCU is, you look at the vastly different tones that you have in those movies. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy is nothing like Ant-Man, which is nothing like Captain America, the first Avenger, which, I mean, and then you look at the MCU TV shows, which are technically in that universe too, and Daredevil is like nothing they're doing in the movies.
The connection of those shows are ridiculous, but...
They're connected, Adam. They're completely connected.
Sure.
Jeff Loeb can
say that, sure. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, but with all due respect, though, even the things you've mentioned, sure, I get that. But what the vision I have for Shazam, there's no place at all for Zack Snyder's Batman to be in it. Zero. It wouldn't work. And to be the film that I think it should be, it wouldn't work. So
well,
that's
I'm not saying Batman shows up. I'm saying you can do it separate in terms of you don't have to have anybody else showing up in the film, but as long as it's within the same continuity, so potentially whenever Justice League 2 happens, which I still firmly believe it's going to happen eventually, Shazam can show up in that movie. And so in his solo movie, we don't have to have any references to any of the other past films. We don't have to have any references to Henry Cavill's Superman or Ben Affleck's Batman. But to leave that possibility open, and we know already, because Dwayne Johnson has already said that his Black Adam, he's going to fight Henry Cavill Superman at some point in this universe. And so it stands to reason that even beyond what I'd want Shazam to be, even though beyond the fact that I want it to be within this universe, I mean, The Rock has confirmed that Black Adam's going to, at least the plan is right now, for Black Adam to fight Superman at some point in this universe. And it stands to reason. I know that Black Adam's no longer in this solo Shazam film, but it stands to reason that Black Adam and Shazam are in the same universe, because eventually I'd assume they are going to confront each other in a potential Shazam sequel. And then you can draw the conclusion that if Shazam's in the same universe as Black Adam and Black Adam's in the same universe as Superman, then that's all connected there.
That's a lot of whataboutisms, though, and The Rock saying that on Twitter is not, with all due respect, quote unquote, confirmation of anything, right? That's A. B. You're right. Affleck's or Jake Gyllenhaal or whatever, whoever's going
to
be Batman next shows up. It's still the Snyder Batman. Yeah. It's still the DCU. Even if it's a film that would have to still open, you know, as you say, leave the door open, that Batman would still have to exist in this universe. And what I'm saying is that whether he's there or not, he can't even exist. You know, it has to be, it would be so ridiculous for any of those characters to even exist, especially in the stylistic way we've seen them in recent films, for this film to work in what I think would be the best formula
for.
Yeah, if
you're going as crazy, like, you know, off the wall as Rick is hoping, then it Batman in that sense does look ridiculous in that place. That I will say. It depends on how out there they're willing to go with Shazam. That's going to be the determining.
But you're right. It's going to be the determining factor on that. But here's the thing: we have it's coming. You know, this movie is going to get made, and we'll know soon enough.
We'll know with the casting too, because there was a rumor that a DCU character was going to sort of mentor, you know, Billy Batson. But so we'll see. If one of them shows up, then we know it's connected, right?
At the end of the day, just be good.
Just
be good, right?
Amen to that.
However you get there, just be good.
Movie like Wonder Woman where I don't have to agonize and defend why I like certain things and why I don't like certain things. Like, just please, I'm getting older by the day. I'm getting gray hair just by having to have arguments about Man of Steel, which are 4 years running, and now we're gonna add, you know, BBS and Justice League to the pile. It gives me a headache. But
and regarding just one more thing regarding the casting itself, I'm not familiar with this kid at all, but like Rick said, I too trust their casting. I mean, they've been pretty much, with one exception, pretty much I've been so happy with the casting with these films as of late. So
what is your one that you don't like? I don't mean to interrupt.
Jesse Eisenberg's Luther.
I knew you were going to say that. Isn't it funny how we have a major disagreements on these films, with the direction they're going? But I absolutely love Jesse as Luthor. It's weird, isn't it?
I like this take. Here's why I like this take. Then we'll move on to Batman 89. I like this take because it wasn't the land salesman, you know, and no disrespect to Hackman or Spacey, but I just think that was so, like, it's been the standard in live action for, you know, in live action film for so many years. It's like, finally, there's something else.
I liked his motivation and his actions in the film. I just didn't like the performance itself. You see, I wanted something more along the lines of what I've been waiting for in a live action movie is what Michael Rosenbaum gave us already on TV, which is, you know, I had to make a Smallville reference every episode, Adam.
What about Luthor in the post-credit scene in Justice League, though?
I liked it, but that's such a small sample size. So it's like, if those quirks really are gone, then I'll be quite happy. If he does wind up evolving, and the next time we see him, he is more of the cold, calculating Lex that I've been wanting to see. It's frustrating to me. He was a step in the right direction in terms of his actions and motivations. As Adam pointed out, he wasn't doing the whole real estate crap. But in terms of, like, Gene Hackman, he cracks me up, but he was played completely for laughs in those in the Christopher Reeve movies. Then we get Kevin Spacey, who at times I got the Luther from him that I wanted, but he was really trying to do a Hackman impersonation for a lot of the movie, which I'm not sure I put completely on him. I think I put that a lot on the fact that they were really just trying to make a movie set in that universe, and that was sort of supposed to be a follow-up to Superman 2. So it's like, I was like, man, can we finally get the cold, calculating Lex I've been waiting for in a live-action movie? Of course, like I said, Rosenbaum gave it to us on TV, but it's frustrating to me that we still haven't gotten it in a live-action movie yet.
Well, I'll drop this bomb, and then we'll move on to 89. Of course, it's you guys' show, but I'm talking about in terms of my contribution of hijacking anything.
Sure.
You don't like him in that role. My guess is you probably won't see him again in that role, but we'll get to that later. All right, yes, Batman 89.
Yes. Jordan, do what you do best. Give us that brief description, and we'll get into it.
Say something clever, because I should have pulled it up, because you brought it up earlier, and then we started talking about Shazam, and I should have pulled it up during that time. But here we go. Okay, never mind. All right. Yep, another one-sentence description from IMDb. So.
Classic. Vintage.
You got it. The Dark Knight of Gotham City begins his war on crime with his first major enemy being the clownishly homicidal Joker.
Surprisingly, that's good enough for our purposes. Rick, what are your, as we always do on the show, what are your, start with, I want to get a sense of your general thoughts, but how, like, going into this film when you first saw it, what was your take?
Well, I'm 42 years old, so I was a freshman in high school when that movie came out. And at that time, the comics had really sort of taken an interesting turn, especially it really started in the 80s period. Really, we go to the late 70s. But obviously, Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns really turned everything on its head. And so you're kind of seeing Batman in this different light. Like, it's a he's almost like an anti-hero, and is, you know what I mean, as opposed to just right and dark and more of a vigilante than necessarily a crime fighter. So when the first trailer that I saw, and also, you know, the in your head, Batman on film, in cinema, on television, in live action, however you want to phrase it, is Adam West. I mean, that's who he. You know, I actually enjoyed the serials, and I have them, but, you know, I didn't even go back that far. I mean, Adam West was everybody's Batman. So the first time, first of all, let me just say this. I remember reading in the back when there was this thing called the Dallas Times Herald that doesn't even exist anymore in 1988 that Michael Keaton was cast as Batman. I remember reading that in the newspaper going, they cast Mr. Mom as Batman. Beetlejuice as Batman. What? That's weird. So you knew that going in. And so that was really controversial. But then that first teaser trailer, I'm so speaking in 21st century here. The first, like, commercial for the film, I was watching Cheers, lying on my floor, just watching an episode of Cheers one Thursday night on NBC. And all of a sudden I just see the Batwing. And I'm like, what was that? You know? And then you see Nicholson's Joker and your jaw drops. And then you see Keaton's costume, which, by the way, I think is still my favorite Batman live action costume as Batman 89 overall. Overall, I think it's just freaking awesome. I don't care if he can't turn his neck. It's awesome. And the first time you see that in him, you know, he raises his cape up and you're going, holy shit, this is the Batman that's been in my head, that's coming out the pages of Frank Miller, that sort of we've been sort of getting a slow burn introduction to over the last, you know, 5-10 years. And here he is. And it literally just blew my mind. And I've never had my mind blown as much since then in terms of any pop culture, anything, including anything else, Batman, Star Wars, anything else I love, than I did that first commercial for Batman 89. It changed me. It made my love for Batman go in a way. I mean, I didn't think I could love Batman more than I already did. And that commercial just made me fall in love with him in a way that I never had, or then his whole entire universe. And the fact that you know, Lando Calrissian was going to be Harvey Dent. What? How cool was that in the late 80s to cast a popular white character as, you know, with a black actor? Like, that wouldn't be that's something that wouldn't even be a big deal now, but that was a big deal then, you know?
Oh, awesome.
To give credit where credit is due, the Batman TV show cast Eartha Kitt as the third Catwoman.
Yes,
so that was also awesome. But it's just everything about it. And of course, Nicholson's Joker. I mean, get out of here. And that first commercial where he hits the paper and he's like, just wing freak, where did they get a load of me? You know, that line. Oh my God, I want to see more of this. And so, and I love every second of that movie. To this day, I still do. It's just fantastic.
Awesome. We'll get into specifics in a bit, but Jordan, actually I'll give my take, cause I'm the next in line. And then Jordan's the youngest of the group. So, you know, it'll color our perspectives a little bit. I'm 34 as of right now. And so I was 6 when I saw this movie. My only frame of reference was Adam West, because to that point at 6 years old, I had never read a Batman comic. The only thing I knew was Adam West's Batman. And this was the first movie that I can vividly remember watching in theaters. It was my mom, me, my best friend at the time, and then his mom. So we all went. And it just blew me away. Like you said, the visual look of the costume of Gotham City itself, that it takes place at night, you know, because Batman 66, most of it is during the day. And then the car, the Batmobile, all the like just the visual aesthetic of the thing wowed me. And then like seeing it unfold, and you know, you get that was the first time I seen a visual of Batman or Bruce Wayne's parents getting shot. So all these things, like the Batman mythology, started to really be brought to bear with this film, or at least for my primitive, you know, Batman fan that I was at that point. And so it changed me. And it's not like by no means did I stop watching the reruns of 66 at all, but it was just, I was so obsessed with this movie when it came out on VHS. I don't know how many times I watched it. My family was honestly got sick of that movie by the time, you know, at a point in time, they're like, okay, enough. Like, how many times can you watch this per day? It's like, we get it, right? So I was just, if it wasn't for this movie, would my Batman fandom be as prevalent as it is today? I don't think it would be. Would I have this podcast? No, probably not. So this movie was transformative for me.
You know, that's a really good point, man. I could have easily have quote unquote outgrown Batman if it wasn't for that film. But that film was a turning point, and the aforementioned comics I referenced as well. But when you're growing up with Batman, I was born in 75, and you take everything about him in terms of just how he's portrayed. And then you get up to where you're in high school, and then Batman 89 comes out. It's almost like Batman was growing up with you.
Right.
And it gave me permission to like him still in high school. And then Chris Nolan gave me permission to love him still as an adult. You know what I'm saying?
Like you can see it. Yeah. Nolan was like, don't worry. It's like Nolan was patting us all on the back. Don't worry. It's okay to like this.
Yeah.
You don't hide anymore. It's okay.
Then you get into your 40s and you have no more F's to give.
Well, I don't care anymore.
you just love him anyway.
Well, exactly. At this point, I am what I am, and whether you like it or not, too bad. Jordan, what's your take being the youngest of the group on Batman 89?
It might be partially as a result of that, but I think we're living in a little bit of a bizarre world on this episode because, believe it or not, I think I'm going to be the slightly negative one on
You're
this
fired.
Podcast.
No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I have an immense amount of respect for Batman 89 and for what it did for the superhero genre on film, and specifically for Batman on film in terms of being, I mean, we wouldn't have what we have today without this movie because this is really what, obviously Frank Miller really did, well, really Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams started sort of bring Batman back into the dark, into the comics in the 70s, and then Frank Miller continued it in the 80s and really hammered home with that. But then really in terms of mainstream sort of recognition of Batman as being a dark Avenger of the night, that was Batman 89. Obviously, in terms of doing that on film, particularly. And so I have an immense amount of respect for the film as far as that goes. That being said, the film itself, taking it just as it is, taking it as a singular product, there's a lot I like about the film. There's also a lot that I really do not care for in this film. That's I am younger than you guys, so I did not see this in theaters. I saw this on VHS growing up. I have a little bit of a different experience with this film, so that maybe plays in a little bit of my views on this film. I enjoy this film, but I certainly don't have nearly the love for it that you guys do. So I'm excited to get into this.
Okay, now, quick question, Jordan. Sorry if I interrupted you there, Rick.
Sure.
But so what is the – when you – in your formative growing up years, what was the first Batman movie that you saw in theaters?
The first Batman movie I saw in theaters
Yes.
was Batman Begins. And
really?
I know I've talked about it in the show.
How young are you? I should have done my homework. Oh.
Well, and yeah, I've talked about it before on this show how the first DC movie that I ever saw was Catwoman.
Oh, good Lord.
but the first Batman movie specifically that I saw in theaters, the first DC movie I saw in theaters was Catwoman. The first Batman movie specifically that I saw in theaters was Batman Begins.
All right.
Well, and that's part of it. You see Batman Begins first, and that's your introduction to Batman, right? It's hard to look. The film itself, Tim Burton's 89, is just like, as you said, is a singular product of, I believe that's how you phrased it. It has problems. It's not a perfect movie by any means, but you're right on the nose, Jordan. This film, I'm 14, 15, and it transformed Batman for me. And you didn't have that experience because by the time you came around and were old enough to really understand what was going on screen in front of you, that transformation had already taken place. In fact, sort of a weird metamorphosis, I guess, took place as well, because we went from Batman 89 and then it crashed and burned, you know, 8-9 years later with Batman and Robin. And then it was what you saw was the revival of Batman on film. And so going back to watch 89, I can see that being a little weird. Everything is relative, right? Think about, you know, I think about something like Star Wars. We're in the middle of Star Wars fever right now. And I know a lot of people, Jordan, that are your age, that are or a little older than you. Some are my nephews. Some are, friends that have kids. I mean, hell, I could be your dad. And as far as age goes, makes me want to throw up saying that, but it's true. I don't feel like that. I still feel like I'm 19, but I'm not. But anyway,
it's all about how you feel, Rick.
It's all about how you feel. But you know, there's
19 in spirit.
There are like I saw. You know, I saw The Empire Strikes Back on opening day in the theater with my sister and my parents in 1980 or 81, whatever year that was. And that's, you know what I'm saying? And then people that your age, the prequels are what they grew up on. That's their Star Wars.
Attack of the Clones is my favorite Star Wars movie, and I'll stand by that.
It's not my favorite by any means, but I love you for defending it because I still love the movie. And you know, you and I could do a separate podcast just on Attack of the Clones alone.
Actually, listen, hell yeah.
We're gonna do Jordan and I are gonna do an offbeat podcast on May the 4th or around there our just our general thoughts on all things Star Wars. So, hey, if you want to come back for that, we're more than welcome to have you.
I would be honored. And Jordan and I talking about a clone, geeking out on clones, that's not something I can do very well. I can do it with Mark Hughes. And bless you, Mark, if you're listening. But you know,
by the way, I will say this, and you mentioned Star Wars, because we are in the middle of the Star Wars fever, and I can't wait for the Last Jedi. But
I see it tomorrow at 2.
Okay, I'm going to sneak into the theater with you. I'm just going to fly and sneak
Come to Dallas. I'll buy you lunch and we'll go see some
We'll sneak in. It'll really be like our youth. We'll just try to sneak into a press screen.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. And I didn't want to lose my larger point on that, but please go ahead, sir.
But the first thing, the first Star Wars movie I saw in theater was The Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
So that, you know, and right. I enjoy the prequels. Look, they're not the best. They're not the best of either trilogy, but they're so enjoyable. I enjoy them. I mean,
I did too. Revenge of the Sith is still my third favorite Star Wars film, and that might change tomorrow. We'll see. But to come full circle in this, it's sometimes, you know, art is it's how you relate to it in your time of life when you saw it. And yeah. Look, Superman 3 with Richard Pryor is a dog shit movie. Okay.
Yep.
I'm sorry. I just cursed on your show. I'm not sure.
No, go ahead. It's okay. We're
but,
good.
Just
wait till Batman and Robin. You're going to hear lots of
But I will. I don't care that that's a crap movie. I still love Superman 3 because I saw it in the theater and I loved it and I just still do. So sometimes, but I can look at Batman 89 from 30,000 feet and say there are issues with the film, but it still has so many great moments and what it did for Batman and cinema, I'm just forever grateful.
So now that you brought that up, that's a good segue. Let's jump in. What are the things you liked about the film? And you can go full spoilers now. We're over the spoiler, wall.
And Batman 89,
yes.
Still my favorite Batman scene in any Batman movie, still the opening scene in Batman 89. I love that whole interaction he has with the criminals. And, he holds the one guy over and he's like, don't kill me. He's like, I'm not going to kill you. I just want you to do me a favor and tell your friends about me. Think about what he's doing there. He's holding a guy over, I don't know, they're 15 stories up. Mm-hmm. And he's telling him, I'm not going to actually drop you, but you're going to do me a favor. And you're going to spread the freaking word about who I am, dude. Mm-hmm. And that gives me chills. It's awesome. And then when he jumps and then the guy goes over to the edge of the, and he's looking down and he's gone. He's vanished.
Yeah.
Total Batman. And I like how, to give credit where credit is due, there's things about Justice League I like. I like the Batman opening scene that's, I think, kind of pays homage to that scene.
It does.
Because And
it's great. I mean,
It is a great, it's a great scene. But going back to 89, that's probably my favorite scene in any Batman movie ever.
Right. And so, like I said, the opening of the film was phenomenal. And before you go on, you continue with other things you liked with the film. One of the things that I really loved was, even beyond that, the opening credits where you're like traveling through the bat logo. That to me was, because I'm like, when I first saw it, I'm like, what is happening here?
Right.
I think we're on a rooftop, but then we're not. And I'm like, where are we going here? And that opening shot of Gotham City. And it was all fantastic. But I'll get into that more when I get to all my likes. But continue listing off, stuff you really enjoyed about this film.
The car is awesome. And I love the cast. I like how stylized it is. I love Jack Nicholson's Joker. I love when he's Jack Napier. I know that's completely not canon, but I don't care. I'll accept changes in film sometimes as long as they work and it stays relatively close to source material. But one of my favorite moments is when Jack is sitting there and then Jack Palance is like, Jack, I want you to take charge of this or whatever he says. He's like, me? And he flips his card around and it's the Joker card.
Right.
And that, I love that foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. And then Jerry Hall walks in. And a little side note about Jerry Hall. She was a model from my hometown, Mesquite, Texas.
Oh, nice.
And, she hooked up with Mick Jagger at some point in her life when she was younger. And that kind of was her claim to fame. And then she's in a Batman movie. I'm like, we went to the same high school. But actually, we didn't. She went to North Mesquite. I went to Old Mesquite. I shouldn't say that, but we were neighbor high schools. How's that?
So next time Bill brings up where you're from, you can throw that at him.
Well, Jerry, from Jerry Hallland, dude.
That's right.
And look, fight in the alley. completely blew my mind.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, check his wallet. Funny line, first of all. Yeah. Check his wallet. It's awesome. And then when he stands up, just kicks everyone's butt. And then the martial arts guy, like, flips out of the wherever he from the dumpster, wherever yeah. he came from, the, you know, and then he pulls and then you see the shift in Keaton's eyes and his body posture. Like, OK, this is a different kind of guy. I'm gonna have to fight differently here. And he goes right into it. It's just like he's a ninja and just God, it's awesome. And I love everything that has to do with the stuff about his parents. I like when he goes to the alley to drop the rose and Kim Basinger is kind of picking up, Vicki Vale's picking up on who he is and connecting those dots. I like all that about it. And then look, Michael Goff's Alfred, beautiful, yeah. beautiful Alfred. In fact, the one thing about Batman and Robin that's good is there's a great Bruce Wayne Alfred scene. It's a beautiful scene.
Agreed.
And it's all that's Michael Goff, man.
Yeah.
So the casting, some of the action sequences, the suit. And then my favorite line, I think, is when Keaton drops his Batman voice at the very end. They're on the cathedral rooftop. And he says, excuse me, you ever dance with the devil to pale moonlight? You know, and he's total Keaton. And then, yeah, I love that.
That was great. Some of the things that I want to mention, and you guys can both chime in if you want. You mentioned, like, so the opening of the film, when we see that family going to the alley, you know, walking through the alley, the tourists. I was so convinced at 6 years old that I'm watching the, you know, that's Bruce and that's his parents. And the film plays it ambiguously so that you could easily believe that that's the case. And I like the fact that, you know, they sort of mug that family and Batman ends up, you know, serving justice to those criminals. That is quintessentially that's Batman's mission statement, is to make sure, you know, what happened to him doesn't happen to anybody else. So the fact that he is getting, in a way, retribution for that family that was robbed at, you know, at gunpoint, it really speaks to some quintessential Batman lore there. And I just love the way they framed that and how, you know, for a bit you think it's like, you know, because Batman Begins, you actually see the murder of the Waynes, like you actually go along with it. And for a moment when I was 6 years old, that's what I thought I was watching. You mentioned the rooftop scene, Rick. I mean, that what a way to open, to introduce to Batman. And he's doing everything you've come to know, at least once you've read the comics. Everything you've seen Batman do is, you know, sort of instilling fear into a criminal by dangling him from a rooftop. It was great. What I loved about this was the, you know, Jack Nicholson's Joker, I thought was fantastic. I mean, you know, I hate comparing him and Ledger because they're so different. But what I loved about the film was that they really played up on the, you know, they had the whole crime boss, the crime organizations. And that's another aspect of Batman that especially in the early comics, if you know, from the late 30s and stuff, that's what he was fighting, crime bosses. And so to the way they balance this film balances the crime boss angle with the more fantastical the flamboyantness of the Joker and the craziness of the Joker, I think they do a really good job with that and how, you know, it was Jack Palance's character that set them up at Access Chemical for the fall, and just how cocky Jack Napier was, like, you know, because basically he's going, you know, behind Grissom's. That was Jack Palance's character's name, right? Grissom.
Grissom, yes.
Yeah, so he's going behind his back with his girl and he thinks, oh, he doesn't know anything, but meanwhile he's well aware of what's going on.
You set me up over a woman.
Yeah, oh, that was a great
woman.
Line. That was a great line. So that whole thing was, you know, again, because I have an Italian background, I'll say it. The mafia stuff was great. So I love that angle of it. Even you mentioned earlier, Rick, if we think it's an origin film for Batman. It's definitely an origin film for the Joker. I will say that. And look, the stuff at Access Chemicals, to me, that is in my head canon, that's how I see the origin of the Joker. And there have been comics that have somewhat mirrored those scenes with the Scott Snyder, recently did some, a few years ago, it was like with the Red Hood angle, where Joker was working for the mob and he was the Red Hood for a time, and they replayed, if you will, the origin scene, and it mimicked, you could definitely see cues from 89 in the art panels for that. So for me, it is definitely an origin for the Joker. Whether it's an origin for Batman or not, I'll say yes, with the caveat that to me, the minute his parents are shot, Batman is born. So in that sense, I think of it as an origin. But what I did like about the movie is that I love how they played Batman as the urban myth. You know what I mean? The media was questioning his existence and what to make of him. The criminals were so freaked out about him. And just the way they refer to him is very mythic in nature. So I love that angle of it.
There was no blood in the body.
Yeah.
No shit. It was all over the pavement. Yeah.
I just love that because, that's
a great line.
There's elements of the character that are like that urban myth of it. To me, that's a great angle to use for Batman. And I just love that aspect of it. In terms of Michael Keaton specifically, his Bruce Wayne, first of all, was not in the typical sense that we know it today, the billionaire playboy. He was a billionaire, but he was a recluse. Even as Bruce Wayne, like, he's hosting a party and he's like, when Vicky Belfort asks, do you know where Bruce Wayne is? He's like, something to the effect of, I'm not sure, or whatever he said. So you can see that he's really like, Tim Burton views Bruce Wayne as more of a recluse than the playboy facade of the billionaire, because you don't really get much of that in either 89 or Batman Returns, the facade angle of the billionaire. So and with an actor like Keaton, I think that the recluse, the hyper obsessed, he's obsessed on the mission and all that. I think that was, that was the right way to play it with Michael Keaton's casting. And just like you said, the best thing about what I like about Michael Keaton as Batman and as Bruce Wayne, there's another, like, you can see it in his eyes. He's unhinged, right? And Bruce Wayne, to an extent, to do what he does, has to be unhinged. So, and I love the fact that, Michael Keaton is not 6'2 or 6'3. He's, what is he, 5 foot? Being generous, he's 5 foot.
Nine, maybe? 10,
maybe.
Yeah.
And so, even though Batman has that costume, but, he's got the mask and everything, you can't see Bruce Wayne. But if Bruce Wayne enters a room and it's Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne, like, nobody's going to stand there and think, oh, yeah, that guy's moonlighting as Batman. Like with Christian Bale and Ben Affleck, if somebody, has the wherewithal to be like, he's got a crap ton of money, look at their heights, the body frame. If somebody's smart enough, and if the movie cared to ruin the suspension of disbelief, with Bale or Affleck, you could certainly make the connection. But with Keaton, there's no way of making that connection. And that's why, in part, his casting was genius. I loved the Vicky Vale as the photojournalist. Her performance was great. The other thing I loved about Bruce Wayne and Batman is that, one of the charges against the Burton Schumacher era of Batman is that you never see any of the detective aspect of Batman's character. You do. It is present in these films. Like Bruce Wayne uncovers the formula that Joker's using for the Smilex, when he's poisoning the cosmetic products. So he uncovers all that. You just don't see him doing the legwork on it. You know what I mean? But the detective aspect of Batman is present in these films. to a degree. So I think that's a misnomer to me that there's no detective work being done by Batman, especially in the Burton films. The Joker, Jack Nicholson, to me, there's an element where he's playing, you know, because we know Jack Nicholson, you know, you see him at the Laker games and all that. There's an element of Jack being Jack in the role, but, and certainly he didn't outright scare me the way Heath Ledger did, but there is an insanity to his Joker in the sense that, you know, when he does kill Jack Palance's character, there's just a pure glee and enjoyment on his face when he's doing it. Like he's having the time of his life as he's, you know, putting bullets in his former boss. And you know, there is an element of, I got a lot of, not, it certainly wasn't the same, but there were elements of Cesar Romero's Joker, I think, in Jack's performances, almost like a little bit of a homage to it. And even in Danny Elfman's score, in certain parts of the music, I got a little bit of a Batman 66 vibe to some of the elements of the Joker theme. I heard little cues just as nods to it, or at least that I thought. And even, you know, the whole thing with the gas and poisoning the, you know, at the anniversary with the balloons and all that. That is, you know, as you go further, you read comics and you read storylines of the Joker. That is, you know, the methods he used to try and kill mass amounts of people is very true in keeping to you know, classic elements of the Joker. And look, I'll say it right now. You mentioned it earlier, Rick, the changes to continuity. In this movie, Jack Napier is the murderer of the Waynes. It is not canon by any means, but it works for the story. And in that sense, I really don't care that it's not canon. And I'll be honest with you, until I started reading Batman comics on a more frequent basis, for my formative years, I believed that the Joker was the murderer of the Waynes. Because remember, in Batman 66, there's no mention of who killed the Waynes. It's just I think it's mentioned in one episode that his parents was murdered. And that's the only reference you get. So to me, for the longest time, this was canon in my head. So I didn't know any better. And even knowing better today, given the context of the film and the story being told, I was okay with it. And I thought it was genius that we got it in flashbacks in this film. But like we experienced it through his memory, through Bruce Wayne having a memory of it. And I thought it's a cool way to do it because and it was part of the look on Keaton's face afterwards. You really feel his pain through that memory. Like you feel the pain in the memory with him. So I just love the way it was. It was handled. Like Rick said, I love the suit. Like, look, Affleck is the most comic accurate, no question. Or I think you said it on Facebook or Twitter one time, Rick. It's Frank Miller accurate, I think is how you described it. But the 89 suit is just, there's something, like it's just cool looking and it's menacing. And you could understand why the common criminal would be freaked out by seeing him. And you're right, Rick. That alley fight was fantastic. I actually liked Batman's fighting style in this. I really did. Sure, it was, you know, 99.5% of the stunt double doing all the work, but it looked great. Like because I'm a 20 some odd year martial artist myself, seeing the stunt double or, you know, Batman, let's say, do a sidekick and do it right brings me a lot of joy as a martial artist. So I got to give props to that. The other scene, aside from the alley, that I think is great, the third act within the whole the cathedral, inside the battle inside the cathedral with one of, you know, Joker's goon there that he basically he bangs his head against the bell and then the guy falls to his death. And again, Batman killing, whether it's he's been doing it ever, you know, in the movies he's been doing it since day one, whether it's sort of half-hearted, not intentional, but it just happens. So it's like, I just play it off as, well, Tim Burton's version of Batman is the early 30s, or sorry, late 30s version of Batman, where he did, you know, for a brief moment, you know, he wielded a gun and he killed people. So I just excuse it off as that, even though I prefer the Batman that has the code of no killing. But the cathedral stuff, right from him battling the thug to his confrontation of the Joker, I thought visually Batman in a cathedral at night just looks so perfect. Especially, you know, when he opens the scene, when he opens the doors and he's just walking through it, just, man, that's like a, if I could get a good still shot of that and have an artist paint it, man, I would make that purchase in a heartbeat. All of that stuff was just, it blew me away visually, like I said. And visually, the Joker, that's another thing I want to mention about the Joker. You know the scene where the media or the news media is outside waiting for, it was supposed to be a police press conference, and then one of Grissom's associates comes out and speaks to the media, and then the Joker shows up and he's got that suit on with the hat, the top hat. That image, correct me if I'm wrong, I may be wrong on this in terms of timeline, but that is right off of a cover of Death in the Family when Jason Todd got killed. Like, that outfit is right off of the cover. Now, did that comic come out before this movie, or was it after?
It was before.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, then this movie seems to be taking inspiration from that. And the other thing I love, the car chase, you know, when he's going back to the Batcave, the theme in that, I think it's Descent into Mystery, I think is the name of the theme. It all works together so beautifully. And I'm biased towards the 89 car because my dad, I think it was in 1990, took me to a car show here in Toronto, and they had the 89 Batmobile, and I got a picture with it. So I am incredibly biased towards that car. So yeah, overall, there are so many things that I love about this movie. It just, whenever it's on, if it's on TV, I'll stop and watch it. Like, even though I have the Blu-rays, I'll sit through commercials and watch it. And I never, honestly, it's one of the ones that I never get sick of. And I at least watch it once a year. So those are some of my specific likes. Jordan, is there anything specifically, what are your specific likes that you want to key into? Before we go into dislikes and hand it over to Rick again.
Are we going to touch on the origin thing? Because I know you brought it up. Should I touch on that first?
They're your likes, so touch on what you want, yeah.
Okay, all right, well, just in terms of the origin, I absolutely do not see this as a Batman origin. I agree with you that it is a Joker origin. And frankly, I'll get into this in my dislikes, but not a particularly good one in my opinion. But in terms of it being a Batman origin, I do not see this film in that way at all. Because to me, yes, you do see the Wayne murder, but like, you see the Wayne murder in BVS too. And I don't think anyone will argue that BVS is a Batman origin film. So to me, yes, it's set early in Batman's career. And yes, we do see the Wayne murder. But unlike in Batman Begins, we don't see his first night in the Cape and Cowl. We don't see any of his training. We don't see how he got to that place. Yeah, we see what sort of launched that with the Wayne murder, but we don't see any of the growth. So, Rick, do you want to chime in on that first before I get my life, though?
No, roll.
Okay. All right, then. So in terms of my likes in this movie, I love Keaton in the role. I love him as both Batman and Bruce Wayne. I think he gives a really nuanced performance in the role. And his Batman voice is just outstanding. I love that as well. I think Michael Goff is Alfred throughout all four of the films. It just gives a really good performance, and you really see his sort of his fatherly role to Bruce really comes through in these films. I love the scene. One scene that always stands out to me is him cleaning up after Bruce at the party, and that always cracks me up at the beginning of the film. But I love an original character in this film, Alexander Knox. I love him. Funny story, I actually had a college professor who told me that she's friends with Robert Wool. And anyway, that just interesting tidbit there. I thought that was cool. I haven't gotten an autograph or anything. I would have loved if I had been able to swing that through somehow, but that didn't happen. But yeah, Alexander Knox in this movie, he's an original character. I find him really funny. He just brings a lot of humor to this movie, and he's a likable character. So I like him in the movie. Pat Hingle is Gordon. This is not Pat Hingle's fault, but you'll see why this is in my likes in a sec. But I really feel like he got a disservice in the way Gordon was written in these films, but the reason I'm throwing this in with my likes is because this is the movie out of the four in the Burton Schumacher quadrilogy where he does get the most to do. It's still not as much as I'd like, but I'm going to put this in my likes because he does get he gets more to do than he does in any of the subsequent three films. So yeah, there you go. I love the Batmobile. I think both of you guys brought this up. The design is just, it's incredible. I love that car. And again, the scene with the descent and mystery theme, as Batman's taking Vicky to the Batcave, that scene is just awesome. I love the Batwing as well. I think the Batwing looks so cool. I don't really like the scene. I think the scene is ridiculous where he takes it up to the moon and makes the bat as cool as it looks. It's a ridiculous scene, but in terms of the look of the Batwing, it is, I mean, it's spot on. I dig it. Nicholson's Joker is not going to be in my likes, but there's a couple scenes with him that are going to be in my likes. But I'm going to really focus on him in my dislikes, which might be blasphemous to some people, but I will try to justify that. But in terms of his scenes in my likes, there are two of them that I'm going to put my likes. One of them is the scene with the surgeon. You brought it up, Adam. You brought it up that you do like Nicholson's Joker, but he doesn't scare you like Ledger's does. And I think that's my main criticism of Nicholson, is that he never really scares me in this movie except for two scenes. And those two scenes are the ones I'm about to bring up. One of them is with the surgeon, and that scene I find just terrifying. You don't really see him in that scene. You only see him from the back, but just him with the surgeon. He has him to hand in the mirror, and oh man, that scene scares me. But and then the other scene is when he's in Grissom's office after he's just killed him, and he starts making that, I don't really know how to describe it. He keeps saying oop, oop. You know what I'm talking about when he makes that noise?
Yeah, with the newspaper.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
That scene always creeps me out as well. So there's a couple scenes that I think he was, I think it really worked for me in. But overall, I'll get into it in my dislikes. That Nicholson's Joker overall does not work for me. In terms of other stuff I like about this movie, I love the look of Gotham City. I think yes. Anton Furst, his design for Gotham City is just incredible in this movie, and I love that. There are, again, there's a lot of stuff that I feel like I'm bringing up in my likes where I'm like, part of it's partially a like, but then I'll elaborate on it in my dislikes because it's partially a dislike as well.
Yeah.
But Danny Elfman's score, obviously I love his Batman theme. There's a lot of his score that didn't work for me, but then again, there's a lot of it that does work. So I'm going to throw that in with my likes, and then I'll talk a little bit about my dislikes with regards to the score when we get to dislikes. But overall, I think that should do it for my likes pretty much.
Sweet. Rick, before we're going to get to your dislikes, but before we do, chime in on the origin, not origin debate that you asked us to bring up at the top of the show.
I think Batman 89 was an origin film until Batman Begins came out.
All right.
Okay, that's kind of how I put it, because we don't see the how, but we see the why of Batman, and that's really the first time we've seen that on film. We've never seen his parents assassinated in live action. Obviously, that wasn't in the TV show. So, you know, sometimes this stuff can, you know, we're splitting hairs and it's semantics, but it is certainly an origin film of the Joker, and it's certainly an origin film of Batman to the sense that you see why he became Batman. Where Batman Begins shows you the how.
That's a fair explanation.
And I'll have to look at the date, but I referenced earlier The Man Who Falls, and Jordan, you're better at comic books than I am, man. What year did that come out? That was about the same year 89 came out, right? It was 88, 89 that comic was released, was it not?
I wish I could say I had that on the top of my head, but it is 89.
Yeah, we could Google it, obviously. I don't, when I have Skype pulled up, I don't like messing with my computer.
And yeah,
I
me neither, because it screws up often.
Yeah. And my phone's charging. But anyway, at any rate, around that same time, or at least in close proximity, we get a comic that really shows the how.
Right.
Kind of interesting. But so to come full circle, is it an origin film? Sorta.
Fair enough. And the other thing I'll mention before we get into your dislikes, Rick, I forgot to mention this in my likes. It was the emphasis on the news media and you know with the it was very much mirroring. This is where I think they took a lot of their cues from Dark Knight Returns, because the panels had a lot of that split screen with the two news anchors in the comic, and you see the two anchors, you know, two or three times in the film. It sort of pays homage to that with the prevalence on the, and the focus on the two news anchors. So I just thought that was a nice nod that I forgot to mention earlier. But go ahead, Rick, give us your dislikes of this film.
I dislike the fact that Tim Burton took his sequel and made a movie that looked and felt nothing like this film. Anyway, I'm kidding. I'm not kidding, but I'm not going to get on a Batman Returns bash. I figured you guys like me better than Andy from Holy Batcast, as much as we love Andy, because you let me come on this show and do this. That poor guy had to talk about the sequel.
This is going to start a Twitter war that I just want to
keep
myself from.
You know, it's funny.
We love. I'll say this: we love all our guests, and we thank them all for wanting to come on our show.
Oh, you know, I'm kidding. Andy loves Batman Returns, so I'm sure he was excited to talk about it. I'm sure he did a great job.
We try to bring guests in to talk about something that they like, and I mean the reason for that is not because we don't want negative opinions on the show, but it's because I think it's more enjoyable to come on to talk about something
you're
enjoy.
You're gonna get negative opinions because you're making me do Batman and Robin, so you're gonna get negative opinions.
I literally would call in sick on a Batman and Robin podcast. There's nothing for me to say. I watched that scene with Alfred and Bruce where he's sick, and then that's it. But so what I didn't like about Batman 89, look, you know, I don't like the fact that Alfred just walks Vicki Vale into the Batcave. And I do, to talk about Batman Returns again for a moment, there are parts of that film that work. I like when Bruce Wayne referenced that to Alfred. He's like, "What, you want to talk to me about security? Aren't you the one that just kind of rolled in Vicki Vale? Like, hey, we're working in the Batcave. Hey, yes. Here's Vicki Vale." Funny tie-in, and it sort of like retroactively made that a little better for me, because that's how I felt. I'm like, really? Like, there's not even enough between them. She hasn't earned that, right? Anyway, did they even go on a date other than just that one night? And all of a sudden, she knows he's in it. And then Alfred rolls her in, and just kind of weird. but so that didn't work for me. I would like to have seen more of Billy Dee's Harvey Dent. Maybe it's better that I didn't, because it wasn't until Lego Batman that we got to see him do that part again. but I still liked him in the role. I wanted more of it. And, you know, there was some of the stuff like they could have done better. Like the ending scene is so epic in so many ways, with the score building up and he's standing on the cathedral and the bat signal looks beautiful. But that is so obviously a miniature that I look at that going, why couldn't they have just had Michael Keaton standing there?
Or a
stunt double, or just a person. It's so bad when you look at it, and it's completely unnecessary. I don't like how easily the Batwing crashes. I mean, I get the zaniness with the gun and everything, but that was just a little much. You know, he pulls out the gun and he blows down the Batwing. That could have been thought out a little better. But that's kind of nitpicking stuff. Other things I didn't like, it's hard because I really love the movie, and there's not a lot I don't like, right? That doesn't work.
Here, yeah.
You know, so those are that's a good list. I think some of the stuff with the news reporters, especially after they caught on and their face was messed up and everything, and they're just giving the news in that sort of monotone. I thought that would have worked better if Burton played that a little bit more from reality,
right?
To really truly differentiate between, because once Joker hijacks the hijacks a common word in this podcast for me today. I don't know where that's coming from, but when he is he takes over the commercials, he infiltrates the studio. Remember, right. He's going through he's got his little shopping cart, whatever. That transition isn't what it should be, because I feel as though the news reporters were still kind of zany and over the top, and I don't know. There's something about that could have been better, but again, that's nitpicking. And that's really about it, man. There's not really a whole lot more that I don't. I tell you one thing I do want to mention. My second favorite scene is when he's bringing Vicki Vale to the Batcave. The yes. music, the way she's looking at him, and she's trying to, and he's just cutting with his eye over, and then that whole conversation that ensues inside the Batcave. And you know, she says something like, she brings up the Joker, and he says he's psychotic. Well, some people say the same thing about you. And he has this moment of what people. It's almost like it bothered him. Yeah. And there's a lot of nuance to that. And Jordan, you said that he gave a very nuanced performance. I could not agree more. It is a very nuanced performance. And to be fair, he did it in the sequel as well. He was still great. But that I just want to mention that scene, because I think that's a pivotal scene when he stands up and walks away from her, but the light still catches his eyes.
Yeah, that's the great part about it. A lot of it was the focus on his eyes, like his eyes in the cowl, which you really don't see because it's so dark in that moment. It visually was stunning, and it just added to what Michael Keaton was trying to achieve there. So it was,
I think the worst scene is when he's standing there and it cuts away, then it comes back to him when he's with Vicki Vale. Mm-hmm. And it comes back to him, and he doesn't have the black makeup around his eyes, and it's so obvious, and he just tears his mask off, and it's gone. Oh, wait, yeah. That's the sequel.
That's actually
the sequel, and that was Michelle Pfeiffer. Never mind. And there's my little Batman.
Trying to sneak those returns, Rick.
I like Batman 89 so much, I have to, pile on Batman Returns for what I don't like about 89.
It really is funny, though, because it's like the exact opposite for me, because I love Returns, and I'm just so lukewarm on this movie.
we've established that you live in your own little bizarre world already in this podcast. It's all good.
Here's what I say about Batman Returns, and I won't bring it up again, I promise, is that I think that it's a fantastic Tim Burton movie. I think it's a terrible Batman movie. So that's my view.
That's a fair point of view. I mean, again, that's the beauty of Batman is this, is that there's a portrayal for all of us to love, and there's things about certain portrayals that we won't love, but it's all good because in the end we love the character, and that's
right.
That's the most important thing. In terms of my specific dislikes for this, Gordon. Oh, I mean, poor, and it's nothing to do with Pat Hingle. It's just. He does nothing. He's useless. He's utterly useless. I mean, I thought he was useless in the 66 show. He's about just as useless as he was there in this. I mean,
would you agree, Adam, though, that he has a little bit more to do in this one than he does in the subsequent sequels?
He has more to do, but it's just because he has more to do doesn't mean it's a good rendition of the character. I mean,
I agree.
Still sad. He's got more to do. He's got more of nothing to do. Yes, anything's better than him showing up on the rooftop in a robe and slippers. So in that respect, okay, I'll give you that aspect of it. So I really didn't like that. I actually agree with Rick when the Batwing sort of falls apart and it's just shot down by a ridiculously long gun that Joker pulls out of his pants. That was a little bit, it's like, that's a little cheesy. It's a little too cheesy. And the Batwing in that instance looked like a toy or some miniature or something like that. By the way, I did have the Batwing toy, and I had the Batmobile toy. I wish I still had those toys, but, you know, it is what it is. Other things I didn't like, I'm grasping at straws because I like this so much. Alfred, again, I agree with Rick. Alfred letting her into the Batcave was just. I mean, if I was Bruce Wayne, I would have fired Alfred in that moment. I'm sorry, like you know this is my mission, the whole thing, and you compromise it by letting her in here. And again, the relationship was a little bit, or the intensity of the relationship, the how far along it got, to me was a little bit forced because they had, let's be honest, it is what it is. It was a one night stand. And I don't know how much time passes between the beginning of the film and the end of the film, but her profession of love, I was like, really? I mean, was he that good in your one night stand that you, oh, like the way she professed her love, I'm like, really? It seemed a little too much for me. Those are really the things that I can. And the other thing was, as much as I love the look of Gotham City and how stylized and gothic it is, Gotham City felt too small because we're going around, like, what the problem is, they were, because I think they shot in a studio in London, correct? And they built a lot of those sets. It felt very, very stagey. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're passing the same theater over and over again. It was like they were on one or two streets, and that was the extent of it. But I did like how gothic and atmospheric it looked. It just felt like it was too enclosed and too small for my, you know. And this is in part because you see Batman Begins, and you see the Chicago, and the you get all that scenery and those location shots. Maybe that's colored my perspective, but one of my negatives is how small and compact the areas of Gotham City we actually got to spend some time in looked. Those are my negatives. I know Jordan probably has more than either Rick or I combined, so I'll throw it over to you, Jordan.
Yeah, so some of this is probably going to be sacrilegious. So I know our buddy Steven, it's his favorite Batman movie. So I'm going to tell him, Steven, you might want to mute the podcast right now. I have a little bit of a hefty list here. Okay, the opening thing with the opening credits going over the bat symbol, that just makes me dizzy. Every time I watch it, just makes me dizzy. Okay, I much prefer what they did in Returns where it's going through the sewer. I think that's pretty fantastic, and this just does not work for me. It just gives me a headache. I think the idea is cool, but I'm sorry, it gives me a headache. Okay, this is probably going to be the most sacrilegious thing I'm going to say on this podcast. Rick said it was his favorite Batman scene of all time. This is not my favorite Batman scene of all time. The scene with the thugs on the rooftop, it does not work for me on pretty much any level. And the reason for that, part of it is Danny Elfman's score, okay? Danny Elfman's score makes me completely unable to take that scene seriously. Like, when the thugs are trying to run away and Batman throws the batarang and tries to wrap him by the leg, and it makes that sound effect, and you hear this weird music from Danny Elfman that, like, makes it sound like a cartoon, it completely takes me out of that scene. And then there's the part where the thugs, I guess it's a little before this, actually, where the thugs, like, are about to run out the door, and then they turn around, and it's like, I don't understand why they turned around and why they didn't keep running, because, like, they literally shot Batman, then turn around to run, and then you can't even hear Batman getting up, and they don't even pause for him to get up. They just turn back around as if they know he's going to get up, and then he stands back up. And it's like that whole scene is just a complete misfire for me. So I'm sorry, guys. I just – that scene does not work for me. Moving on, I feel that the Joker's origin in this movie – now, here's the thing. This movie – I know two of the main problems that a lot of people have, which is one, Alfred letting Vicky into the Batcave, and two is the Joker killing the Waynes. Neither one of those actually bothers me that much. So the problems that most people have with this movie aren't really the ones I have. I have a little bit of a problem with Alfred letting Vicky into the Batcave, but it's not that big a problem. What bothers me much more about the Joker is his origin, because this feels like such a bastardization of the Killing Joke to me. It's like, I have no problem with knowing the Joker's origin. Yes, I love how it is in The Dark Knight, where you don't know what it is, and he gives a couple of them, but you can kind of you can kind of pretend that you don't know what it is in that movie. You can kind of go with, well, he was lying in those situations, and you don't really have a definitive origin for him in that movie. I love that version. I think that works. But I also think it can work to do a Joker origin if you do it well. In my opinion, The Killing Joke did a brilliant job of it, because it showed that – what The Killing Joke showed to me is that you can have one bad day and it can basically derail your life like that so much. Just one bad day, one day where these terrible things happened to the guy in that book, and everything completely – become derailed, and you can go mad, and he gives in to madness. And I love what The Killing Joke does, in that it is able to juxtapose that with Batman, because Batman obviously had one bad day as well, but he used it for good, whereas Joker succumbed to madness. And I think that book is just brilliant. I know Rick's a huge fan of that book as well. I think that book does it brilliantly. Sorry, were you about to say something, Rick?
No, I was just going to echo that it is brilliant. I read that several times a year, still to this day. I love it.
It's fantastic. Oh, yeah.
It is the quintessential badassery of the Joker.
Yeah.
And I'm in complete agreement with that. I think it's the best Joker story probably ever written. But here's the thing, and that's part of why I think that Batman 89, that's why I have so much of a problem with it, because it's like they took elements from The Killing Joke and they just completely did away with everything that makes the origin in that book so moving for me, because this guy already starts out as a scumbag. Jack Napier's already a scumbag. So it takes away the whole aspect of him having one bad day that makes him the Joker. And so for me, it's like, when you take a story that I love so much, and obviously The Killing Joke came out slightly before Batman 89, but I don't know, perhaps the script for 89 had already been written by that point. But for me, it just feels like such a – like I said, it's a bastardization of The Killing Joke. And so for me, that origin doesn't work at all. Nicholson's performance, it doesn't really work for me on a lot of levels, because it's so – it's not scary to me. It really isn't.
That's because you saw The Dark Knight in the theater as a young kid, and you saw Ledger's Joker first.
Yeah.
That's probably true. I'm sure it has a lot to do with it, because I love Ledger's Joker. I think he's the best live-action villain ever, DC or otherwise. And so he scared the shit out of me, truly. And so Nicholson, perhaps that is. But here's the thing, though. I saw Nicholson's Joker before I saw Ledger's Joker, because I had it on VHS growing up, and even as a kid, Nicholson's Joker, other than those two scenes, never did it for me. And oh my god, okay, I got to talk about this. The Prince music, Jesus Christ!
Listen,
I love Prince, I really do. I think he's a great musician, or he was a great musician. That's sad, but I can't. Yeah, he was a great musician, and Why the scene in the museum with the Joker coming? It's ridiculous. It is laughable to me, that scene where the Joker comes in with the Prince music on the boombox and starts spray painting the pictures. And it's like at the parade, I can live with it a little bit more, because they play pop music at parades. That works. But the Joker coming into the museum, it takes away all the gravitas of that scene, having that damn Prince music playing as the Joker is coming through the museum. It does not work for me on any level. Batman, the suit, I do like the suit. I think Returns, it's actually an improved suit. The one thing I don't like about the suit, though, and that's why I'm bringing up my negatives, is that prong thing. And I understand it was a legal issue, but that prong thing at the bottom of the bat signal, I know it's a little nitpick, but it really does not look good to me. Let's see. Okay, I got to talk about the Vicky and Bruce stuff, because, yes, I realize I'm predisposed to have issues with pretty much any relationship that Bruce has other than Selina, because I'm such a huge Batcat shipper that anytime I see another relationship portrayed, it rubs me the wrong way. That being said, there are other relationships that have at least not been so grating to me. Like Andrea Beaumont in Mask of the Phantasm was done very well, and I acknowledge that despite the fact that I love Batcat so much. However, with Vicky, that relationship is so dull and it moves so quickly without any real – I think, Adam, you were bringing it up. There's nothing – it moves so quickly and it feels unwarranted.
It felt forced.
It felt forced. Thank you. Yeah, it did. And it comes. Yeah, it just moves too quickly, and I just don't really feel. I don't feel the connection there like I do in the subsequent film with Bruce and Selena. I don't feel the connection that Bruce and Vicky have. I feel that's forced. I brought it up in my positive, but I'll just echo it again here with the Batwing. As much as I love the Batwing, the scene where he drives it up to the moon is ridiculous. The scene at the end of the movie, I'll just jump here, where Batman writes a letter that has a speech to the citizens of Gotham is like, that's something that I could only see working in Batman 66. It's like, I cannot believe that they put that in this movie. It's so absurd to me. Like, it just does not feel like something Batman would do, is write a speech to have Gordon read to the citizens of Gotham. I thought that was absurd. I guess that should about do it, I guess, for my negatives, I think.
Fair enough. Rick, we're at the point. Before we answer, we got two questions. But before we answer the questions, we got to give a rating to this thing. So, depending on how you want to rate it, either out of a number grade or a letter grade, what would you give Batman 89?
Okay, Batman Begins is A+. The Dark Knight is A+. The Dark Knight Rises and Batman are both tied for my third favorite film. And third favorite Batman film, and they're both an A-.
All right, that's definitely a very, very solid grade. And is that grade in retrospect? Do you view it in like putting yourself in a 80s mind frame, or is that just overall still to this day?
Here's what I'll say about it is that if I go back and watch the Richard Donner Superman films. Superman 2 is a hybrid. Mm-hmm. Superman 2 really was basically what we got from Justice League. The only difference is that Richard Donner actually got screwed out of director's credit for that and whatever. But still, stylistically, they're both sort of hybrid films in that way. Because Lester came in and mucked things up a little bit for Superman 2. But still, when I go back and watch even like the original Superman, it feels very dated. Obviously, it was the 70s, and so, right. It's going to feel dated. The 70s was a very tacky decade for clothes. I mean, it just was. Yeah. I was born in the 70s, and so, I'm not dissing the 70s, but I am. but when I watch Batman 89, I don't feel like it's that dated to me. I just don't. And maybe some of it is that I can... I'm a 14, 15 year old again, and seeing it in the theater 30 times, I probably did. I'm probably not even exaggerating in that. I bet I saw it on the low end 20, high end 30 times in the theater.
Wow.
Yeah, I did. Because I mean, there were times I'd see it twice in one day. I did that several times. That starts to add up. You know what I mean? But it's a fair question, but it's almost an impossible one to answer because. Really, I can say that about anything. I can say that about Star Wars. I can say that about E.T. I can say that about Close Encounters or any film that I still love to this day, even the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And are we grading them on a curve because of nostalgic purposes, or are they fundamentally the way they are structurally and everything? And I don't know.
Yeah,
but
no, usually the only reason I ask that is because some people do grade things like that. So I just wanted to make sure if there was a separate.
I think that's a very, very fair question. I'm not I don't have an issue with that question whatsoever, sir. I'm just trying to do my best to explain it's hard to answer that on, and not when you when I say honestly, not meaning you would be dishonest, I would be dishonest, but it's hard to really dig deep and say, am I grading this just because of X, Y, and Z? But at the end of the day, it's like, well, if I'm subconsciously inadvertently doing that, so be it, because it's still an A- for me. So
I totally understand that. Jordan, what's your grade?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
I gotta say, hey, Rick's with me on these letter grades, man. I don't know what your beef is with letter grades, Adam. No, I'm telling you, it's the way to go.
I just prefer to do numbers and then add the little twist that our previous guest gave us a few weeks back.
Hey, Jordan, here's what I love about letter grades versus numeric or anything is how we can really sort of like, I can say, man, it's a strong A-. It's a flimsy A. It's not quite the same thing as an A-. You know what I'm saying? Like we can.
Yeah.
There's more like levels to it, and you can really get in there and nuance the. it's a lot of it's a bunch of BS because we're probably spinning it a little bit and we could probably be a little bit more direct, but I don't care. I like that letter grades give us the freedom to play around a little bit, you know.
I'm with you. Plus, and for me, it's easy.
I just like to grind your gears. That's to be honest with you.
It's all good, man. Yeah, and for me, letter grades are also just in general easier to quantify for me. It's easier for me to think about. I know what a B plus means to me. It's easier to quantify that than knowing what an 8.5 means to me. So for me, that's why it works easier. But for me, in terms of a letter grade, this movie is it's a B minus for me. Like I said, sort of at the top of the show, there's a lot of stuff I like about this movie. I have a lot of respect for what it did for the genre and for Batman in particular in terms of live action. But I also have a lot of issues with it, like I talked about. So for me, I feel pretty solid giving it a B minus.
Fair enough. I'm gonna go with, like I said, our past guest Tim gave us an interesting way to rate things or give us an option. So I'm going to use that option and I'm going to say 9 Joker perma smiles out of 10 for Batman 89. We do have a couple of questions. So Jordan, why don't you get those? You have
them. I've got them.
Okay. Now my suggestion is let's get your Smallville question out of the way because I know you can expound profoundly on Smallville, but let's not try to, don't turn this into a Smallville podcast now, Jordan. Give us the question, and then go from there.
I'll keep this brief. Yes.
I know it's hard for you because you love Smallville so much.
Steven asks, well, this is the second question, but yeah, we're going with it first. This is a great question from Steven. Smallville versus Gotham, which one has done the prequel to the hero better? This one's for Jordan. Thank you very much, Steven. I love this question.
All right, Rick, what do you think? Did you watch either show, and which one do you think?
Smallville was brilliant. I'm going with Smallville. I can't stand Gotham.
That was short and sweet. All right, I'll say Smallville as well, even though I enjoy Gotham much more than obviously Rick does. I will say Smallville because I think two things. It's more tonally consistent throughout the 10-year run than Gotham has been over the 4 seasons so far. And I think there's a lot more aspects and ways to play doing a Superman origin television show than there are a quote-unquote Batman origin story. Because originally the intent was this was supposed to be a Gotham where you know, it was focused on Gordon and the GCPD, but then they probably realized that they couldn't sell it that way. So they've heavily, you know, put Bruce Wayne a lot more than they originally intended. So I'll say Smallville for that reason. Jordan, what's your answer?
I really don't think this is going to come as a surprise for anybody, but I'm going Smallville too. I've said it before on here. It's my favorite TV show of all time. And it's my favorite version of Superman ever as well. I think that what they did showing his journey, Clark's journey from the first season when he was a freshman in high school all the way to him becoming Superman in the finale. I think that it's just such a brilliant journey. And over those 10 years, just the journey you take with those characters and really seeing them grow, I think it's pretty much unparalleled. And I think that what they did with that show was pretty masterful. And I think that it's a brilliant show, a beautiful show, and just an amazing version of Superman. So I'm going Smallville too. Gotham, I do really like. There's a lot I like about that show. It's given me some characters, some Batman characters that I never thought I'd see in live action. It's given them to me, and it's given me great versions of them in a lot of cases. It does make me scratch my head a lot of times. And when they've explored the Bat-Cat relationship, they've done a great job with it, but they haven't explored it enough for my tastes, especially this season. But I do really like Gotham, but for me, it doesn't hold a candle to Smallville. Smallville is always going to be number one.
Fair enough. What's the next question?
All righty. Next up, we have another question from Stephen Maverick Marshall. So this one, he says, what would you guys do now with DC Universe on film? This will be very interesting with Rick on the podcast.
All right, Rick. Go ahead. What would you do with DC films going forward, given the current state of affairs?
I think that what I think they'll do is what I probably would do. Here's the thing, and I'll just say this, and I know this is a touchy topic, and Jordan, you've got a lot of passion for this and everything, and I appreciate that. We have to, and I'm not trying to be luxury here when I say this, but I'm just talking seriously now, but we have to detach ourselves from our personal opinions on these films. Whether you love all these movies and you love these characters and you want to see them portrayed by these actors and carry on so badly, all that's great. But there's also the reality of the business model that this is under, and it's a very serious business. And these films have not worked on any level that you judge films on in terms of critical success, in terms of box office, etc., except for one, which is Wonder Woman. So you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You keep her. There's no, you just do. You carve that out and you keep her. I think that the direction they should go in, and that I suspect they probably are films that are director driven, that are not referencing an extended universe. And I would be very, very shocked if Matt Reeves' Batman has anything to do with any continuity that we've seen so far. And if it does, if I'm wrong about that, which I don't think I will be, I wouldn't advise anybody betting against me on that, but let's just say that I am, because it's possible. Jeremy Irons is Alfred, all that stuff. Okay, cool. Even if they go that route, I'd put fat money. I would have bet big money back in February that Ben Affleck's not coming back, because I had heard a lot of stuff from sources. And now it's just even more apparent at this juncture. So, but regardless of that or not, if they do stick with that, it'll be a prequel. I think he'll tell a story that happens in the events prior to all this stuff, where he doesn't have to reference anything. And that's if it's in the universe at all. And I'm guessing that it probably won't be. I don't see how we see Henry Cavill return as Superman. And here's why I say that. He has been rejected by movie audiences. It's not fair. They have taken a beautiful actor with doing a beautiful performance of a beautiful character, and they have rejected it. It's unfortunate. But you can look from Man of Steel to BVS to Justice League, and the critics have not liked it. They've all underperformed. And that is how you base these things on. The general mainstream audiences have said they really just don't have any interest in this Superman, and it's unfortunate. So what do you do with him? Because from a business standpoint, business, just business, not because I freaking love Henry Cavill as Superman. And if I'm wrong about this and he gets a proper Man of Steel sequel, I will not eat crow. I will celebrate. I'll pay for the booze for the party, okay? All right, so I want to be clear on that.
I want to come
right?
to that party too. That's
right. We'll do it at my bar in Dallas. We'll close the doors down for business. And I'll throw a private party this is the coolest thing I've ever been wrong about. But I don't see how, from a business standpoint, the general audience, which, by the way, aren't guys like us. We all know that, right?
Yeah.
That 85-90% of the people that go see these movies aren't geeks like we are. They don't read comics. They don't follow this stuff. All they know is what resonates with them and what doesn't. And they're going to look up and see Amy Adams as Lois Lane. They're going to see Henry Cavill as Superman. They're going to see that universe, no matter who's directing it, no matter what. And they're going to go, and they're going to tune it out. And I think the studio execs know that. So I don't even see how that carries on. So what I think they should do right now is let Matt Reeves do his thing. Whatever he wants to do, trust him and let him do it. Treat him like you guys treated Chris Nolan. And look what Chris Nolan was able to do. I think Matt Reeves could bring us a Batman film, or possibly a Batman trilogy, that's as good and maybe even better than Nolan's Dark Knight. And I wouldn't care. Give me a better Batman movie than The Dark Knight. I'll take that all day long. I mean, there's no loyalty where that's concerned. I think Nolan himself would say, I hope someone carries on Batman in the tradition that I started him in and makes something as special as what he did. I'm all for that. Run with it. Let him do it. I think Matt Reeves is the right filmmaker to do that. As far as Superman goes, I don't know. I don't see how they don't start over with him. I don't think audiences are going to see him. They're going to associate it with, look, his origin film underperformed. Critics hated it. It's to the point where the studio, as opposed to giving him a proper sequel like they should have, and I think Man of Steel is very underappreciated, by the way. I think it's freaking great, but it doesn't matter what Rick Shue thinks, right? Because it's about how the studio is going to respond to the business aspect of it, in my opinion, is irrelevant. They cheated him by giving him a sequel that made Batman first billing He has 43 lines in that movie. Anybody that's that loves Superman, and now there's the director's extended cut or whatever, but that doesn't count because that's not the theatrical release. But my point is that anybody that loves Superman, and I'm not about to say that if you love Superman, there's no way you can like BBS. That's ridiculous. I wouldn't say that. I'm just saying that anyone that loves Superman, like I do, can at least appreciate why that frustrates me, that I feel like he was cheated on multiple levels. First of all, that should have been his own sequel and not have Batman and everybody shoehorned in it. And then on top of that, he gets 43 lines, most of which is him being mopey and depressed and lethargic and it wasn't someone that was enjoying being in his role. And then he dies, and it was an unfair death, and it was also a whole subplot that was completely wasted in my view. The death of Superman, we barely even knew the Superman. That should have been built up. That could have been a whole movie on its own with Doomsday and everything. And instead,
could have been a trilogy in its own right.
Totally. They completely threw that storyline out the window. And then he's resurrected in Justice League, and he's barely in that movie. And then he's all freaking CGI'd up because he was shooting a Mission Impossible, and Paramount wouldn't let him shave his mustache. And that's because Joss came in and fundamentally changed the film and had to reshoot everything with Cavill. And so his resurrection film is about to do $650 million at the box office. I can't stress enough to you guys how shockingly bad and embarrassing that is for the studio, for those characters, for everything. It's horrific. There's no spin. It's horrible. So again, what in the world did they do with this? Three movies, because critics hated BVS. It underperformed at the box office. Justice League is a disaster at the box office. Doesn't matter if you love it, Jordan, or anybody else. You have every right to. I personally really like it. I think it's a fun movie. I think that we could have gotten a lot better, but it's okay. It works in a lot of ways, but it doesn't matter what Rick Shue thinks. We're talking about a business standpoint. I don't see how they possibly do that. There's not one point in any cinematic history with a franchise that we can point to that would say, Rick, you're wrong. Think about X, Y, and Z. To the contrary, look at previous films that are major box office movies that come from franchises or are franchises themselves, I should say. Look at Superman Returns. Okay? It had decent reviews, did pretty good at the box office. I mean, it was 2006, so you have to consider inflation and everything right, if you're looking at the numbers. But that was it. That wasn't enough for the studio to say, we're going to carry on and double down with Brandon Routh and Bryan Singer. They killed it. Henry Cavill's now been in three movies, and they've all had the same fate, and it's getting worse. So think about that. I'm going blank on his name, Deadpool, Green Lantern.
Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds, thank you. I couldn't get my Ryan out of my head, Ryan Haas. But hi, Ryan Haas. Same thing with Green Lantern. Not really. I don't think that's a terrible movie.
No.
But again, it didn't resonate with audiences, and they pulled the plug on it. And we can do this all day long. And that's unfortunate that that's where this is at. I don't see how, from a business standpoint, they carry on. Now, here's what I'll say. Aquaman is filmed, right?
Yep.
I have no proof of this, but what I'm saying is that I bet you if we could talk to any studio executive off the record, they would echo this, that if they knew that Justice League was going to be under $700,000 worldwide, which is likely the case, that the critics hated it the way they did, and general audience members are torn on it. It's not what it was supposed to be. They would not have greenlit Aquaman. If they knew this was going to happen, that film probably never even would have been made. But here's the deal. It was in pre-production during the pre-production of all this other stuff while that stuff was being filmed. So they're stuck with it. Now, that doesn't mean that it won't work. I think James Wan is really probably going to deliver something really awesome, right? So then what do you do there? Well, that's real simple. And I say this all the time. You make a sequel. That's it. You just make Aquaman 2. This isn't rocket science. With Wonder Woman, she's going to be in another period piece. I almost guarantee that. And I don't know if that's completely confirmed, but it seems as though the that's an easy fix for her. You can give her a trilogy of her in period pieces. I mean, really,
yeah.
You can, right? And then Aquaman, you can make a sequel. I hope Shazam, for reasons I mentioned earlier, is it's its own thing, regardless of the status of all this, because I want it to be a zany, offbeat thing. And then I just want Matt Reeves. Don't handcuff that guy, man. Let him do his thing, whether by some miracle it is Ben Affleck, which I doubt, or Jake Gyllenhaal, whoever it is that's going to be his Batman. Let him just make his own movie. And I bet you if they do, we're going to have another Nolan-esque Batman franchise on our hands. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, none of us are going to complain about a badass Batman movie. And Jordan, even you, if what I say is true, or maybe true is not the right word, but if what I say is accurate, and that's the direction they're going to go, I can't even see you sitting through a Matt Reeves film, the credits roll, it's just epic and it better than the Nolan films. And you're sitting there and you're going, I just really wish there was a Superman cameo in it, though. You're not going to think that. You know, you're just going to be just blown away by this awesome Batman movie.
I think the only way Jordan would be upset is if they go a whole trilogy without bringing in another iteration of Catwoman.
Right. And so that's what I think they're going to do. And, you know, what I want them to do. Now, if I could somehow put if I could put fairy dust out to the world and say, you people are freaking crazy, don't let this Superman get wasted, and Henry Cavill gets a Superman sequel and it works, man, listen, I don't want to see that recast. It's unfortunate. I'll say it one more time, then I'm going to shut up. This is not about my view or my opinion or my emotions about this. This is about the business. From business perspective, I just don't see how they carry on with most of this stuff. I just don't.
Here's what I'll say, and then I'll let Jordan end us off on that before we say our goodbyes. But I think, first and foremost, the best thing to do is focus on fantastic solo films. Deliver fantastic solo films. Rehabilitate the brand. Because look, to a degree, I've liked all the DC films entries. Or at least elements of all of them. But the focus, and I think the Vulture article from a while back pointed out that they were going to de-emphasize the shared aspect of the thing and focus on solo films. And I think that's the right way to go. I think Matt Reeves' Batman, if anything, it'll be a prequel, but I'm leaning towards it's probably going to be its own thing. And Jordan, I know this is going to break your heart, but Ben Affleck ain't going to be in that movie. It's not going to happen. And again, look, the idea that Matt Reeves is going to come in and just make one, I don't buy that either. I think he does have a trilogy in mind, and I hope it's awesome, as awesome, if not better than the Dark Knight trilogy. And I think that's a possibility with Matt Reeves being unrestrained and leave the guy alone. Let him do what he's going to do. In terms of, you know, Aquaman, like Rick said, if it's good, and I think it will be, because James Wan is a fantastic filmmaker. And if you see in the early promotion, like they released a picture from Aquaman recently, and they had a little blurb from James Wan, and he's basically already distancing his film from Justice League in his blurb.
And let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
That's a significant thing that he's doing. And this isn't just somebody that's doing a offbeat comment like, you know, The Rock or anybody else or Affleck on Kimmel saying, yeah, I'm directing. This is a film that's in post-production or at least halfway through being filmed. They're knee deep in it. And he's making a declarative statement that this is its own thing, period. Right. And so there's something about that that's very telling. And if there were any Justice League references in that script at all, I bet they're out now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. With Wonder Woman, keep letting Patty Jenkins do what she's doing. Let her do it for another film, another two films, three. Hell, make five Wonder Woman movies. Just keep Gal Gadot around as long as humanly possible is what I think. But trust in Patty Jenkins and just let her carry out her vision. With Superman, look, I love Henry Cavill as Superman. He's my favorite Superman. I hope to God there's a way they can find a way to keep him. And the only caveat I'll say, and I don't know if this moves the needle for you at all, Rick, but here's a couple of things I'll mention. You mentioned Ryan Reynolds. Well, he was in X-Men Origins Wolverine as Deadpool, and that was utter crap. Critics didn't care for it. The fans of the character didn't like it, either Wolverine's portrayal and certainly hated Deadpool's portrayal. Yet they brought him back in the role of Deadpool in a totally different film. The other point I'll make is the X-Men franchise as a whole has had some real stinkers in it. You know, X-Men 3 and, what was the first half reboot that they did? First Class. That didn't light the box office on fire either. And yet they've carried on with a quasi-continuity. I mean, the X-Men films, the point is, they've thrown continuity out the window and just carried on, quote-unquote, in the same universe.
Maybe. Yeah, and that's just it. They don't their continuity is they don't have to worry about it. Right. And to be fair, too, even on face value, the first two films were fantastic.
Yes,
have a lot of goodwill. Other than Wonder Woman, we haven't had that.
Right. So, but what I'm saying is maybe that's the route they take to bring Cavill back, like the whole, you know. Make no mistake, I'm not saying make it like Deadpool. I'm not saying that at all. But the idea that Ryan Reynolds was in a terrible Wolverine film that wasn't received well at all by either critics or box office, yet they continued with two more Wolverine films and they gave Deadpool with Ryan Reynolds another go. So maybe that happens with Cavill. That's what I'm hoping. But I don't know. I hope there's some way they can get him back, but I just right now I'm tongue tied with what they do with Superman.
It's unfortunate because what we saw in Justice League after that horrendous resurrection aspect of the film, yeah. But once he's back,
right?
You know, he's Superman again, yes. And like we were getting in Man of Steel, like it's great. And again, I'll throw the party if I'm wrong about that. I'll supply the booze, okay?
And the one other thing I'll say that Warner Brothers needs to do, first of all, once you hire a filmmaker, like make sure their vision coalesces and combines with what you want to do. First and foremost, that's number one. And number two is once you hire them and once you've agreed, let them do their thing. When you let the filmmaker do their thing, 9 times out of 10, it's worked for them, like the Dark Knight trilogy and Wonder Woman. So that's a must. And the other thing I'll say is the next time we see that's how much entrenched he is as Superman for me. The next time we see Superman, whether it's Henry Cavill or it's not Henry Cavill, or even if you do a Flash film and whatever films you do, solo films going forward, they got to get the budgets under control for some of these solo films, because to me, it is asinine that you're spending $270 million, and I know it wasn't all counted to Superman Returns, but $270 million for Superman Returns, and then $225 million for Man of Steel. Now, look, I know a Superman movie is expensive, but when I look at, and I hate doing this comparison, but look at Guardians of the Galaxy, okay? All the, you know, 3/4 of that thing is CGI, right? That was made for $140 million. You're telling
me. Well, don't even look at that. Look at what the CW shows do, and they spend just a couple million dollars an episode.
But I'm equating movie with movie. So
don't reshoot 30% of the movie either. It's also a problem.
But what I'm saying is, Rick, you know a little bit more about the movie business than I do. Is there not a way that they can make a Superman movie or a Flash movie for $140 to $150 million?
That's a little bit above my pay grade to be able to say what the budget should or should not be. But I know I can say this. They can do it a lot cheaper. And the problem with Justice League is that they went in and made so many changes. I mean, look, 30% of that movie is reshot by Joss. And it's apparent in the film if you watch it. Yeah. You can't deny that. I mean, we reported that forever. Everybody thought we were idiots and liars. I'm like, no, we'll just wait till the movie comes out and everybody will see what we're talking about. And of course, it's accurate. And it cost them a fortune to do that. A fortune. They had to break contracts. They had to do all sorts of things. They had to get Henry out of Mission Impossible. They had to, you know, they got to pay for that stuff. I mean, it's crazy. And then they had to pay Joss, and they're still paying Zach. And it's that whole thing is a train wreck behind the scenes. And that's part of the problem as well. So you have to have a streamlined director and not change directors midway through, or, you know, whatever timeline we want to talk about them. And that opens up a can of worms. But at the end of the day, yes, they can do them cheaper. Now, but I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jordan. What were you about to say in terms You're about to say something about the shows, though. What was it?
Yeah, the Arrowverse shows shoot each episode for only a couple $1 million. And it's like, yes, those special effects don't look as good, but let's say you just double that. And then I know movies are longer than TV episodes. So if a TV episode is 42 minutes and a movie's 2 hours, let's say you double that again, you're still looking at like less than $50 million. And like, I don't understand how movie budgets are so ridiculously exorbitant, and then you're looking at the TV budget and the amazing stuff, which, I mean, if you just watch the Crisis on Earth X crossover that they just did, they did some incredible stuff in terms of superheroics on TV with a very small budget. I'm like, you could, even if you raise it up a little bit, you could still do something on a vastly less budget than what they're doing these movies.
Yeah, I think you need $100 million plus for a Superman or whatnot, but my point is, look, let's say Superman or Man of Steel was $150 million, right? And it makes what it made worldwide. Then you're looking at something that you know, didn't underperform, right? It would have made the studio money. So, that's my point. Those are my points. Jordan, we gotta close this out. Give us your thoughts, and then we'll say our goodbyes.
Yeah, well, I'll just make it real quick. To me, he asked what we want them to do with the DC Universe, which is a little bit different than what I think they're going to do. But in terms, I mean, mostly stick to what I think they're going to do, which is I think they're going to focus for the time being on solo films. We know pretty much no matter what, we're getting Aquaman next year, we're getting Shazam the year after, and Wonder Woman 2, and we've got Matt Reeves' Batman film coming on the way. And I think if they focus on those, and if those are successful, which I think they will be, then they keep making those, and then eventually we wind up getting another Justice League team-up movie. And with regards to Henry Cavill's status as Superman, I really don't have any reason to doubt that he won't be back. And the reason for that is, here's the thing, WB contractually has to continue making Superman films. They do. And so here's the thing, as much as it pains me to say this as a big Superman fan, he's not the billion-dollar character that they think he is. They need to stop expecting so much out of him. To me, another Henry Cavill Superman film would not make any less money than a reboot of Superman. It wouldn't. Like, it would be the reason that Man of Steel underperformed, the reason that Batman Superman slightly underperformed, and the reason that Justice League is underperforming currently, it has nothing to do to me with, well, I'll just focus on Man of Steel because that was a solo Superman movie. It's not the cast that people it's not that people aren't responding to the cast. If you make a good Superman movie, it doesn't matter if Henry Cavill's in the role. Like, I don't think if there's two possibilities, if one is doing another solo Superman movie with Henry Cavill and one is rebooting the franchise and making a new Superman movie, I don't think that the reboot is going to make more money than the Henry Cavill movie is what I'm trying to say here.
It's not just about money, though. It's also about goodwill. You know what I mean? And there's no goodwill with the Superman right now, Jordan. There's it's all three films the critics hate. They've all been contentious with fans, all three of them. Even Man of Steel, as much as I love it, it's a controversial Superman movie. You have him killing Zod. You have basically his father more or less committing suicide. You have his father telling him you should have just let those kids drown. I mean, there's a lot of things in that Snyder Superman universe that is off color and a little bit people are taken back by it, and they didn't respond well to it. I have friends, and this is not just anecdotal. I have friends that are huge Superman fans that even liked Watchmen and don't hate Zack Snyder, and they absolutely loathe this portrayal of Superman. They can't stand it. And there's that from just fandom alone, and then mainstream audiences, no one gives a damn. And that sucks to say that, but it's all reflective, not just in the box office, but also in reviews. There is not anything that suggests that people care if Henry Cavill returns. It's not anything in critics, and it's not reflected in box office numbers. So where exactly would that come from?
Other than the mustache, it sounds to me like people, like coming out of Justice League, I know a lot of people had issues with the film, but it sounded like to me, most people were pretty pleased with the portrayal of Superman in that movie specifically once he came back.
But your overall thing is, if you had it your way, you'd focus on, just so we get back on point, your overall thing is that if you had it your way and you were the head of Warner Brothers, you would focus on solo films and do another solo Superman with Henry Cavill. That's what you're saying.
Oh, hell yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do pretty much what I think they're doing right now, which is that.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's fair.
And you know what? And I love your passion, brother, and we all love these characters and want what's best for them.
I want to go to Rick's party. So that's
what this is real. This is real simple, because we're going to all know for sure. In the next year or two, it'll be very telling. Yeah. But I think there's going to be a lot of stuff that we're going to find out the first quarter of next year. I bet by March we know who's the next Batman. Little things like that.
I can't wait. Yeah. I just give me more info on that Reeves movie. Damn it. I need it.
I heard the Gyllenhaal stuff a long time ago from actually a non-BOF source. And so I've known about that for a while. But I didn't know how accurate it was. It's a good source, but it was just somebody that was privy to something that they had heard. So I had heard that, then it went public. I was like, oh, that's interesting, because, you know, so-and-so told me that. I wonder if there's validity to it. So we'll see. It'll be interesting that, I know John Campia picked up on that and talked about it. So maybe it is him. Maybe it's not. We'll see.
The one other movie I want before we close out, the one movie I want that Warner Brothers, in my opinion, they got to do everything to push this through and leave the director alone, is Chris McKay's Nightwing. I want that to happen so bad. Warner Brothers, don't screw that up. Because he's the perfect filmmaker for that film. And he's got such a passion for it. With that, Rick, is there anything you want to plug social media-wise? Where can we find you?
Follow me on Twitter, ShoeRick, ShewRick. Obviously, I'm on Batman on Film. And tomorrow night, I'm going to be on El Fanboys podcast talking all things Star Wars. So I'll be doing that show tomorrow evening. And we'll be tweeting about that. And Star Wars Last Jedi comes out next week. I'll see it tomorrow. And we'll have an official podcast analyzing that episode as well with Zeki Hassan and Paul Herman. We're probably doing that on the 23rd or whatever that Saturday is. That way we can wait a week for everyone to see it. And then that way we can talk about it with spoilers, right?
Sweet. I'll be seeing you Friday. So I look forward to your non-spoiler comments and then your full spoiler review. Jordan, where can the listeners interact with you?
You can find me on both Twitter and on Instagram at BatFanJordanV. I also want to say we are a proud member of the Batman Podcast Network, which, of course, BOF is the sponsor of. If you go to BatmanPodcastNetwork.com, you can find all the other Bat-tastic podcasts that are there. And also, I want to solicit some iTunes reviews. So if you enjoy what we're doing, or if you don't, and you have the opportunity to leave us a review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it.
And if you want to converse with me, it's at Superhero Sci-Fi on Twitter. And Rick, I just want to say thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure. I hope that you'll come back. We have a couple of ideas that we've been tossing back and forth, so we hope that'll be we can make that work. And I want to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and enjoy Star Wars, my friend.
Thank you guys so much. It was an honor to be on. I appreciate it, Jordan. You're a good sport, buddy. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely, man. It was a blast. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Likewise. Take care, guys.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
And for everyone else, we'll be back next week with our Christmas episode. So long, everybody.
Bye-bye.